It's April
10th?
9th. And it's Ken Kellerman in Charlottesville. We're going to be talking to Dave Hogg about the NRAO interferometer leading to VLA. And also here is
Ellen Boutman,
Tanya Burchill,
Sierra Smith.
Okay. Actually, Dave, before we start, something just came up in the last days about open skies. And what? You didn't send Dave. Did you send Dave your thing that you just found?
No, no. October 1959 announcement of the NRAO visitor. Visiting scientists programs at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. This was published in AJ and also went to Science, although I haven't looked to see if it appeared yet in Science, but it says that the National Radio Astronomy Observatory was established by the National Science Foundation to make available to scientists from any institution facilities for research in radio astronomy. The observatory now has in operation an 85 diameter radio telescope together with receivers for work at various wavelengths in the range 75 centimeters to 3.75 centimeters. Miscellaneous other facilities are also available. The facilities of the observatory are open to any competent scientist with a program of work in radio astronomy, regardless of institutional affiliation. And then it goes on to talk about how to write to the observatory.
That's clearly the document that Tony was seeking. That's the basis. The stuff I sent Tony is fine, but it's not as central as that document. So that was good that you found that.
But all that document does is specify or document what was already to be established NRAO policy.
Yes.
And it doesn't touch on a more delicate and sensitive issue of foreign use.
It was any seems to cover anything.
Nevertheless, it was sent to Science, AJ, and PASP. As you well know, the Radio Astronomy Journal of the time was Nature. It wasn't sent to Nature. So my interpretation is, of course, any competent scientist, that didn't exclude foreign scientists, but didn't go out of the way to...
I think that you're spending too much time parsing the English language. That's all that you're going to get. So it better serve for open skies because there's nothing else. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that established the policy that was then implemented at the observatory, which I discussed in my note, but my note is derivative. It's not the basic. That's it.
Yeah. Well, as far as Tony is concerned, the policy to the NSF, I agree. As far as reconstructing history, that's not the full story.
I don't know what other story there is.
You were here then?
I was here in 1959 as a graduate student. Yeah, I certainly wasn't advising AUI on that policy.
But you don't recall any discussion of
I was here as a Canadian, a graduate student, observing with the 85-foot telescope. That was kind of a demonstration of policy.
That's good. Good point, yeah. What's your recollection of when we started to get significant numbers of use from outside U.S. institutions? So I recall in the early 140-foot days, there was some Canadian use, but not much else, I think, from outside the country. Metzger, when he went back to Germany and that crowd, did they?
Well, I thought the Germans were using the 300-foot. Wasn't Wendker and those folks, weren't they ahead of the 85-foot? I mean, the 140-foot. I would have to look that up, but I would have thought.
When he was here, though. That was when he was on the staff. I mean, we had lots of foreigners on the staff.
If you mean people coming from their home institution, then it probably didn't start being significant until the 36 foot. That's my guess, just offhand. Even the 140 foot didn't attract that many foreign people. Although if you looked in the logs, you'd see, because of VLB and that kind of stuff, you'd see guys at foreign institutions. But
who were the big foreign users of the 36 foot?
The French. Francois was there a lot. Combe. The French chemists. I don't think the Germans came once. I think it was mainly the French.
Then, of course, the VLA, I think, really opened it up.
I was starting to say VLA, and I realized that's 1980, and we were probably having foreign visitors before VLA. Yeah. But
that's when it really became
became a truly international observatory in the sense that you were trying to define it. Yeah, that is not just foreign guys here. Yeah. Right.
Okay, well, let's go back to interferometry in the beginning.
Okay.
The what were the first various people have their own interpretation. Of course, you know, we've heard from Dave Heesch and others about the origins of the VLA. Do you have any recollection of early discussions, the motivation for building the interferometer, where the motivation for the VLA came from? Was it from the staff? Was it from the outside? Was it comment, all of the above?
I think it was more internal. I ascribe most of it to Wade. I really hope and expect that you will talk to Wade, if you haven't, because I think he was the central figure. Heesch understood and probably stimulated Wade to think about these things. But as soon as Wade began to think about these things, he became the prime mover. So he wrote a couple of important internal documents that motivated interferometry. And basically, the idea over a period of some months, probably, possibly a year, took root in the sense that we should do interferometry. We should start making interferometric studies of sources. We can see that this is the way to get more detail about source structure, about source positions, the way Caltech and England particularly were.
What year was this?
It would have been 62, maybe 63. I don't think it was 61 because when I came, we were still single dish people. But I would guess Wade's first paper that I remember was late 62.
But to what extent was the plans with the interferometer two element at that time motivated by its own merits to do interferometry, and to what extent was it motivated to do science with the two element interferometer, to what extent was it motivated as a learning about interferometry toward the VLA?
I think my memory, suspect though it is that in the first year, let us say, the interferometer as a concept was to have an interferometer that we could get our hands on and do science with. But within a year, probably, so let's say the end of 62 plus or minus was, let's do an interferometer. By the end of 63 plus or minus, let's do a real imaging instrument probably unnamed at the time, and use the interferometer to hone our skills and our technology. And so we went ahead with a two-element interferometer. It didn't take long to realize that a two-element interferometer was a dinosaur of an instrument. And so we added a third element for speed and one new station for short spacings. And then we had a synthesis interferometer, albeit a very slow one. But with that, we made pictures of half a dozen important sources. But all in the background, there was then formed a synthesis array group. So I would have to look at the date, whether it was 1965 or 1966. I was deploying site testing hygrometers in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. Wade had already identified these three states as being likely sites for an interferometer. So during the late 60s, I kept offering these data to Ellen, and she kept turning her nose up at them, I add parenthetically. So I think I've thrown them mostly out. During these times, we were getting the first estimates of site. It was clear that the East Coast was no longer good for the site. And then the VLA has its own story about how we took 35 sites and winnowed them down to 7, and then to 3, and then to 1. But that was through the 70s. And so by the site testing, which my memory was in the 66 to 69 region. It's in the book. We were firmly committed to trying to design, build, and operate a synthetic array. So the days of the interferometer were clearly numbered already. But we were learning a lot. Now, the two-element interferometer was a chore. Now, not only did we have to learn a lot of electronics, we had to learn a lot of science. So we took the output of the interferometer without fringe stopping, and we put it on a chart, and we found where the pole of the interferometer was, which is about 4.5 hours west hour angle. And that's when the fringe went to zero. And we'd roll them down the hallway on the second floor of the Jansky lab, and we count fringes from the zero fringe crossing at the pole down to the transit. And that's how we told where the positions were. Yes, basic science.
Who's we?
Well, I for sure. I think Mr. Clark would count a fringe or two. Certainly Wade. Wade was doing a lot of the theory. Clark wasn't here for some of that. As Nigel Keane was, finally, he was doing the fringe tracking. We had almost a mechano set that the fringe tracking. The clock was very primitive. Needed encouragement. Fist. But we got mechanized. And so we did some two-element interferometer stuff, yeah.
And what about the radio link interferometer, the 45-foot?
That was purely VLA prototype.
It was, okay.
Well.
Motivated.
In 1964... there was an IAU meeting in Hamburg, right? I went to that. That was the first IAU meeting. A Hamburg meeting was fine, but what was more important was I was sent to Paris. And I went with Vinokur there, who was our guy, had been here a number of years, very bright guy. Parenthetically, really sad story. This guy was a disciple of Emil Bloom. He was from the French school, brilliant people, very thoughtful. This guy had diabetes, refused to be treated for it, and died when he was a young man. Really Carol, she was so angry with him. As a nurse, she kept screaming at him. You know, he blew her off. Anyhow, he was good enough to take me around, took me down, put me on the train to go to Nancy. On the train in Nancy, I met Hinder, who had just published the paper, Ryle and Hinder, saying, in essence, the VLA wouldn't work, more or less. So that was very interesting. I went to see, I met the man himself at Cambridge, and I went up to Jodrell and saw all the shakers and the movers. But the important thing was we had to contend with the future Nobel laureate saying we couldn't do the VLA at 35 kilometers. And that was probably the genesis of the radio link interferometer. It started at 10 kilometers or 11, whatever it was, but eventually went to 35, and it worked. Now, little asterisk, after work, you have to define work. It worked only sort of part of the time because of the bad atmosphere, but it did work. Then we couldn't have done the VLA with a clean. With a clean and self-cal.
Well, we could have. I mean, it would have.
It wouldn't have been the VLA.
No.
So
it would have met the spec, the original spec, which was only 1%, 100-to-1 dynamic range, or 50-to-1 maybe.
On the 5 days a year. No, I'm serious.
Yeah.
I mean, in the Hinder and Ryle were right. We were right.
Right.
But the only way the VLA became the dominant instrument that it did was because of technology that neither Hinder and Ryle or Wade, Clark, and Hogg knew at the time we stuck our neck up.
Do you have any memory of interaction with Jan Hogbohm when he was using the interferometer and did and develop clean to deal with the problem?
Not clear memory. Not clear memory.
You never didn't discuss it at all? Or?
I don't have a clear memory of it.
What about the, at some point, the competition developed with Caltech?
The competition was very one-sided, right? Caltech was in competition because they felt they were getting rolled. We didn't have a competition with Caltech other than the fact that Caltech thought that they could run a major instrument, and we were absolutely persuaded there was no way they could. Now, I don't know if you call that competition. They did. And as a sometime alumnus, you probably felt that more than I, but the total amount of time I personally spent worrying about Caltech, apart from one misguided trip that I made with Moffat to Owens Valley along with probably Heeshan and others.
Clark.
Was about, Clark. I can't remember who all was on that trip.
You could probably find out, yeah.
Yeah. That was my most serious commitment. Apart from that trip, the amount of time I spent worrying about Caltech is infinitesimal compared to the amount of time I've just spent talking about it.
Why don't you tell us, tell us about that trip?
The dominant thing I remember...
The purpose of it.
The dominant thing I remember, and I'll try to remember something else, but the dominant thing I remember was flying into L.A. and being parked in a hotel out in the outskirts of somewhere so it would be a convenient drive to the Owens Valley. And sitting there kind of bleary-eyed because we had to get up, I think even before dawn, and have breakfast while we waited for the Caltech guys, in particular Moffat, someone, because he came screaming into the hotel, "You gotta come out, you gotta come out, look!" And we staggered up, we looked, and he said, there's whatever mountain it is. Oh, you see that every 2 or 3 weeks. That's great, that's so clear today.
Baldy. About Baldy.
Was it Baldy? Anyhow, that was my introduction to L.A. smog. I mean, for us in the East, it just looked like a regular day. But for a Californian, it was something to be admired and treasured. Now, we went up and we looked around Caltech. And
excuse me, Dave, do you remember the approximate year of this? Or?
No, I couldn't begin to guess.
Okay, again, we could find out.
Yeah. And the purpose of the trip was to see if Caltech and NRO could jointly build a major synthesis instrument.
And?
The answer was no.
Why? So,
I think we had much different. It was not dissimilar to Alma. You know, some people wanted a few big telescopes, and some people wanted a large number of small telescopes. And there are good reasons for making those choices. And the Caltech people wanted nine large telescopes, 30, 35 meter, whatever they were. And we wanted 20, wow, we wanted 40, whatever it was to begin with.
36, wasn't it?
There was a 36, I suppose it was 36, yeah.
What was the Caltech argument for a small number of large dishes?
Easier to calibrate, better collecting area. Well, you did a lot of single dish calibration. The very advanced calibration that's now done by synthesis arrays in an interferometer mode was certainly not done much by us then. And I don't think it was done much by Caltech then either. So you did a lot of work with the single dish to get it. Ryle took it to the extreme. He measured his tracks to a gnat's eyelash, so he didn't have to do any calibration. We and Caltech, too, tended to be a little more rough and ready, thinking we could take this stuff out by calibration, which, in fact, was true. But the bigger the dish, the more sources you could see to do calibration, pointing with. I mean, the 85-foot, the pointing curves on it were, yeah, they were hairy.
So what was the argument for using a large number of small dishes, smaller?
Better filling in the UV plane. That's the Alma argument, exactly, between the Europeans and the North Americans. How many meetings have you sat through where you had curves crossing the cost of receivers and cost of dishes and cost of that and cost of something? Tell me about SKA. You want big things or little things, right? It's an argument of 40 years standing.
So is that the only major area of disagreement?
No. Caltech wanted proprietary time, if I remember. They weren't in it pro bono. They, you know, I believe that. But Heeshan and somebody, Moffat or somebody, went off to the corner at some point and talked about these things. We just talked about, we admired what Caltech had done. When I talk, I don't want to indicate any lack of respect for what Caltech had done. It was an outstanding program. It's just, we never felt that a university could handle a state-of-the-art major telescope.
Various federal advisory committees didn't exactly agree with you.
That's true.
You said that you didn't.
They're all stacked, of course, with university people. It's, to me, the classic Kitt Peak NOAO situation. You stack the board of directors at Kitt Peak with a bunch of university directors from observatories, and you wonder why the U.S. National Optical Observatory is a disgrace. I don't wonder. You stack the board of the NRAO with a bunch of brilliant Nobel laureate physicists, and you wonder why NRL is a first-class world instrument. I don't wonder that either. So the fact that some bunch of astronomers from universities thought the university could run the VLA doesn't surprise me, but that doesn't make them right.
The Dickey committees, I can't remember. My impression was that they weren't radio astronomy observatory directors. but were people like Dickey? But I honestly don't remember.
Well, they weren't radio astronomers. They were university observatory directors.
No.
No?
Well, no, they were physicists. They were from universities, I agree.
Well,
anyway,
through the 70s, I think there still was a discussion every time a project came up as to whether it should be done by a university consortium, or by a national center. It was particularly true in optical astronomy. And so there was the program of Mayall Telescope and CTIO. And for a brief shining moment, the 4-meter telescope outdid the Palomar with better instrumentation, et cetera, et cetera. But the big players, the Caltechs of the world, even the Licks and the McDonald's, they had a bureaucracy that they had to feed.
Is a fine line between a university consortium and a national center.
Very fine line. And we're seeing it now, aren't we? And the 30-meter telescope or whatever the acronym is now. Caltech and Keck. I don't know if that's the last major telescope that will be built that way.
Well, that by that way, you mean the university consortium?
The university dominant.
That's what they're discussing for TMT and.
Yeah, but look who's in there.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a fine line between.
Yeah,
the,
yeah, it's becoming a national center by perhaps another name. But I think that these projects that cost $500 million to $1 billion are beyond even a major technical university. And with due respect, the VLBA, in my opinion, demonstrated that the universities couldn't play in this game. Caltech had to bail out of the correlator, and Lincoln Labs was sucking wind to finish the recorders. And the Maser clocks.
Well, that's the VLBA is.
I'm not going into the VLBA because I didn't know that much, but I watched with horror when, for political reasons, those guys got subcontracts and screwed it up.
That's what I want to discuss about the VLBA. We'll come back to that later. Spectroscopy.
I should ask for your birth certificate. You may not be old enough to listen to this kind of language.
It's awesome.
Spectroscopy.
Yes. Grison.
Barbie?
Grison.
Now, as I recall, that wasn't considered for quite some time.
Yes,
VLA.
True. Because of surface sensitivity, basically.
And that was part of the reason, perhaps, for the Caltech argument for the larger dishes, because they had more interest in spectroscopy.
What did that have to do with it?
As you said, sensitivity, surface brightness sensitivity.
Yeah, don't we have the same collecting area? I take this technical argument to the extreme. The VLA and the Caltech array had de facto the same surface sensitivity in terms of aluminum. And that's, again, the millimeter array argument.
Yeah.
So spectroscopy was not in the original concept of the middle 60s that we're talking about any more than it was for Ryle.
Yeah. So what brought it in?
Caltech, I would guess the success. Clark came. Of course, he had a very distinguished background in interferometry spectroscopy. Caltech effort. We got Grison to help us. We did a spectral line correlator, and Grace and them made it work.
The first correlator was purely continuum.
That's my memory. Yeah. That's my memory.
Caltech always put a greater emphasis on spectroscopy. And at one point, they even proposed just the spectroscopic array.
Okay.
That was a last-ditch attempt to get something.
To separate from...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The cameras, four antennas or six or something.
Now, we all... the core group of Drake and Wade, Menon, those guys, they were continuum people, right? They had line work in a single dish, but their hearts were in doing, Menon was doing his H2 regions, and Wade and Heeshan wanted to do quasars and Cygnus A and all that stuff. There wasn't a scientific motivation until, I suppose, Clark and certainly eventually Grayson. McDonald was so important to us, but he was a continuum man. Miley, very important, but continuum. The Metzgers, Gordons, and Browns of the world were off on 140 foot doing good things there, but not. As soon as you did any calculation, the 36 foot, of course, as soon as you did any calculation of surface brightness, you started to figure out that you've got a lot of heavy lifting to do interferometry. I mean, Clark was what? He was all absorption, wasn't he?
It's his thesis, yeah.
Yeah. So do emission in line. That's, trust me, not for the faint of heart. Now it's fine, but yeah. Back then, no, there wasn't a lot of motivation.
But to what extent was including spectroscopy in the VLA a political decision that is to placate or to address the competition from Caltech?
I can't answer that. I think that by the time, let's say, 70, when Grayson was here and the interferometer was being exploited, and of course there was a lot of interest in the 36 foot 12 meter, it was clear that the line science was in and of itself enough to require that the VLA do line work. Forget whether we had to beat down Caltech or not. I don't know that at all. I think it just was self-evident that the VLA had to be, the concept had to be expanded to include line work. I don't know when that happened, if there's any document that would talk to that point, but you got to get away from this Caltech-focused crap, if I could speak bluntly. We did lots of things without worrying one bit about Caltech. Now, Caltech may have been proposing a six-element line array. If we made the VLA into a line system, my confidence at the 92% level is we were doing it because it looked like there was good science. Westerbork was starting to do it.
Right? I was built for H1.
Yeah. So it was clear that there was science and interferometry at the line. Forget Caltech. I don't think it was a motivator.
Let the record show that there were a couple of Caltech, couple or more Caltech graduates that came to NRAO along with Dr. Hogg.
Absolutely, and they were the fun. After the Harvard crew, which got the observatory going, it was the Caltech crew that made the observatory successful. I don't denigrate Caltech. But what you're saying is, well, did the NRAO look over and see Caltech trying to do a line thing and then rush to VLA to do a line thing to beat down Caltech? No. They rushed to VLA to do line because, partly because of Caltech, partly because look at what was going on in Australia, and partly because of Holland. it was clear that there was a big future in line work in interferometry, and that's why the VLA was morphed into a line system, not because Caltech was proposing. So you got to get away from that. You and Clark and Fomalhaut and Grison, they were core people for the development of the interrail. That's beyond any question. You don't have to make a footnote. What I just want you to stop doing is saying, did you do this in order to beat down Caltech? I don't think most of the time the answer is we didn't give a think about what Caltech was doing. We were doing science.
Nevertheless, the yes. VLA proposal on two or three occasions got deferred in favor of the Caltech instrument. Recommended to be deferred in favor of the Caltech instrument.
Okay.
But the Caltech instrument, the NSF, shall we say, in their wisdom, did not take on this advice and kept committees until the decade review, Greenstein committee.
This is probably all true. I have not looked at this. I don't care about this. I have no experience on this. I'm not even going to discuss this. It wasn't part of my world.
But you did participate in that visit.
Oh, absolutely I did. Absolutely I did. Yeah, no, I went out there. Somebody has a ticket to California. They're going to say
no. One of the arguments I recall against the Owens Valley Array was the size of the Owens Valley.
Right. Right. That was an important argument in our view. In the Caltech view, much less important because they were doing line work and you didn't need 25, 30 kilometers. In fact, we aren't doing 30 kilometer line work very much at the VLA.
That's right.
Due to surface brightness.
Yeah. Right?
So, the line work, that was one of the fundamental differences between Caltech's array and ours was that they stuck to shorter baselines.
I think Heeshan reports someplace or other that he even agreed to build the Owens Valley design.
I remember that. Yeah.
But not in the Owens Valley for the reasons you just said.
Right. Mm-hmm. I believe that to be true.
Was that discussed at this camp?
Fine. Now you're really asking hard questions. It's certainly a vaguely familiar concept. It wouldn't have surprised me if that was, because the Caltech array had a lot of attraction to it. Those were competent people.
Okay.
It was physically small. I mean, we had this 1 second of arc stuff in our head. That's 35 kilometers. And we had this grave concern that a university, as eminent and technically strong as Caltech, couldn't do it. Might even go further and say, in our philosophy, shouldn't do it, right? Should be open, managed, no perks, no guaranteed time.
Well, the preparatory time or guaranteed time is one component. One can imagine a university-operated facility that didn't have a university-operated national facility that didn't have this proprietary time, like Arecibo, in principle. Well, but Caltech didn't want that. You say they would only do it if they had.
That's my memory. I'd hate to go to the stake over it, but that's my memory.
I think I've heard this.
Yeah.
Okay, what about the VLBA?
Much more about it than I. I was very much on the periphery of it. I was certainly around for the Rome Surprise work stuff. I remember Claude Baer, what a sad story that was. And coincidence, of course, I knew Chisholm, who also died early. No, Sinclair. Who was the Queens guy and the VLB?
Well, you mean Alan Yin?
No,
he died later. Well, also early.
No, no, no. There no. was a sing, either Chisholm. Or
I think Sinclair. So because I never knew him.
Yeah.
So he. Yeah. Well, I wasn't talking so much about VLBI, Dave, but actually the VLBA, and at that time.
Oh, how you guys screwed us on the 25 meter? Is that what you want to talk about?
Well, yeah, we could talk about that. I meant more. You were associate director then, maybe, or deputy director, or
yeah,
or assistant. To,
well, yeah. I don't think we had deputies then, but I was probably associate.
Yeah. So,
if I had ever gotten around to talking to Tavia, I guess it was I spoke to her, and she told me how to get my VDA up to date, and I've never done it because, you know, I had other pressing commitments.
So I was referring to the comments you made earlier in the context of your role as an administrator at NRAO.
Yeah, yeah.
Once NRAO, once the VLBA proposal was approved, can you tell us a little bit about subcontracting of various things and your interpretation, which you started mentioned earlier, of how that went and why? And
well, of course, I have a completely warped and twisted
well, so do I.
View
so
of this, so I'll just give you a core straight.
I want to hear your story.
My story is that after the failure of the 25-meter millimeter wave project, the observatory turned its interest towards creating a major front state-of-the-art long baseline interferometer, which eventually became the VLBA. The general outlines of that instrument were understood. It had to be Earth diameter. It had to be multi-frequency to do phase correction. It had to do high frequency to get good resolution. It had to have enough baselines to do imaging of expanding quasars and the like. So by then we were, and the world was, competent enough in interferometers to know generally what we had to build. And generally what we proposed was generally what we have today, crudely speaking. Of course, the technology, the instrumentation has evolved, the tapes, the times, everything else has evolved a lot. In configuration, that was what we had. But how do you get there? Well, there were competing proposals. So my memory is Caltech wanted to do a VLBA. Hooray. Right? There they were again, the upstarts. We had to beat them over the head again. Except this time we had a senior Caltech alumnus who was wielding the cudgel to beat them on the head. Now, having put aside the 25 meter in a painful discussion, which we need not make today, we turned full-hearted to the VLBA. But it was a hugely political thing because all of these observatories that were running VLBI stations, Iowa, Illinois, Massachusetts of some kind or another, California, Harvard Fort Davis, all of these guys had income from these digital. They each had a little grant to run their VLB program. They had students at the universities learning VLB at the university. So it was clear that if you made a VLB array, you'd kill all these observatories off. And indeed, that's what happened. So in some kind of Faustian bargain made above my pay grade, the universities agreed to allow themselves to be killed off, but they had to have access to a powerful instrument, the VLBA. And some of them were more equal than others. So in particular, Caltech, who wanted their own array, said they would build this correlator, which was a choice piece of technology, and keep their students in, et cetera, et cetera. And Lincoln Labs, who had a lot of connection with the NASA timing and space motion program, a lot of money going to Clark and those guys, and they had some brilliant people. Rogers is one of the iconically bright guys that ever walked this earth, as far as I'm concerned.
That's Alan Rogers.
Yeah. So they had a piece of the action, too. Well, so what could we do? Well, somebody, it couldn't have been Kelvin, because Kelvin doesn't smoke, but got into a big old smoke-filled room, and they said, you'll get this, and you'll get that, and we'll get this, and everybody will be copacetic. Well, that's the way it happened. And so NRAO ends up being the prime mover of the VLBA. But we had flow-through contracts, so Caltech would build a correlator, and Lincoln Labs would build tape recorders. And I've forgotten how we ended up doing maser ties, but that was always a lot of heartburn. And now it's pretty straightforward, but back then there was only one maser supplier of any consequence.
That was Harvard.
That was Harvard.
Smithsonian, and, to be exact.
Yeah. And then there were some other little things that really ticked me off. You know, we're doing calculation of beam patterns in a synthesis array. And we find that we can get 0.000% better if we put the antenna not in Green Bank but in New Hampshire. And we are so wedded by getting 0.000% better that we moved the damn antenna out of Green Bank into New Hampshire. Over the bitter objections of a Caltech alumnus site manager at Green Bank, and the bitter objections of probably not an associate director Hogg by then, but somebody, but certainly me, whatever my title was. Crazy decision.
Well, who made that decision?
Beats the living devil out of me. Somebody who had taken complete leave of their senses. Was it Paul? I don't know. Probably
Uno.
Paul. Mort. Anyway, whoever made it should have been taken out and flayed. It was just incredibly stupid. But I perhaps still have the wounds, so I speak indifferently. That was, do you agree? Is New Hampshire a better site than... It was, of course, a package deal. I had found a reasonable site in Puerto Rico. But you have to go to St. Croix to do New Hampshire and get this 0.000% better. So Puerto Rico and Green Bank gave a perfectly good beam. But our highly skilled Caltech alumnus, Walker, found that my point... on .000%, you could go to St. Croix, New Hampshire. And so it was. Over the objections of Sahlstad and over the objections of Hogg, who really didn't count because I don't think I was a player then. I think I was just a wise sage. A
couple of things. To any extent, was the New Hampshire decision coupled with placating Haystack?
No.
No, okay.
No, it was pure,
okay. All right.
Pure UV plane.
Because you alluded to having to satisfy.
Well, we did that by pouring money into them to do tape recorders.
But just to clarify, we abandoned Puerto Rico for St. Croix, not because of Green Bank versus New Hampshire.
They were chained. My memory was they were paired. Green Bank, Puerto Rico.
My memory is that two distinguished NRAO staff members at the time.
Caltech alumni.
Only one of them was a Caltech alumni.
Fomalhaut and Walker?
No, let me finish.
These Caltech guys. If you eat with a Caltech person, you best have a long-handled spoon.
All right, this has nothing to do with Caltech. Two NRAO staff members
happened
to be in Puerto Rico.
Yes.
For other business.
Yes.
And went to visit the potential site.
Yes.
On the south coast of Puerto Rico.
Right.
And became aware, and it was an ex-CIA place.
That
they were abandoning.
Yes. You and I.
Yes.
Yes.
And we became aware that next door they were building a Voice of America.
Proposing.
Planning to build a Voice of America.
Right.
And that's what moved us to St. Croix.
That station never got built. That's probably actually
because,
right.
Because... Yeah.
So the question was, when did we know that they weren't going to do Voice of America?
And it was Frank Drake that convinced us that St. Croix was a dry site, and it was a good place. He had been advocating that for a millimeter. telescope.
There, but for the grace of God, yeah. You're absolutely right.
I don't disagree with any necessarily with your other comments
about in fairness, you're correct about the Voice of America.
It wasn't coupled with Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico and St. Croix were in the same place for all practical purposes. And you argue that New Hampshire and Greenback were in the same place, which I don't disagree with.
Yeah. I felt badly about that decision. When you think about, we have to monitor a station that we could have had it right in Green Bank. We could have done our testing of VLBA equipment there. It just would have made quite a difference in our operation, I believe. In the same sense that we've done a lot of stuff at Pytown.
Yeah.
You know, because we're there. We don't have to hire it done. We can do it.
If you remember the NRAO VLBA proposal used as a recording system, a bank of VHS,
yes,
commercial VHS recorders.
Yes.
What's your recollection of how that ended up as essentially modifications of the Mark III system? Is very different.
I was never sufficiently close to that recording system to know what was going on at that
level. Did not the associate director and there were two associate directors. The other associate director for engineering, associate director for operations, pay a visit to Haystack to discuss their role in the VLBA, and
you understand, during the 80s, I wasn't in management except for 1 year in Tucson.
This was late. Did you not go with Hain?
I don't.
To Haystack?
I could have. I went with Hain a lot of places, but I'm telling you that I resigned as let's call it an associate director, 1 year into Morton's term. Right? I was still associate director fighting for the 25 meter. So the VLBA didn't get going until after the demise of the 25 meter, although it was being designed.
Yeah.
It's possible while I was associate director, I went with Hain, the associate director, to Haystack. But, when the VLBA was going hard in 1981, 1982, I was not associate director.
Okay, what role or title you had isn't important.
Well, it's really important because in 1980 or 81 or 82, whenever the 25 meter was dead, I hired myself up to Bell Labs to do the millimeter array. I wasn't fiddling with the VLBA. So ask me about millimeter array, but don't ask me. I did a sight test as a favor to the company. Heeshan would die. He's rolling in grave for me to call the observatory a company. That was his bête noire. No, very seriously. For the as a good guy.
Sorry, which sight test?
I did sight testing for the VLBA in Hawaii and Puerto Rico. Right? I've got those records. I haven't bothered to offer them to Alan. That was cool. You go to the Saddle Road of Hawaii, and to the right is Mauna Kea, to the left is Mauna Loa, and at the Saddle Road is a high-altitude biological research lab where they try to preserve endemic bird species of Hawaii, the nene, the Hawaiian crow, the nene, the Hawaiian goose, and a couple other things. I tried to hire that guy to run our site testing, because the Saddle would have been a one place for the antenna. He was too busy, but he was very generous. As soon as he found out I did birds, he showed me the nenes and stuff like that. Very cool.
We looked at Mauna Loa, as I remember.
We did.
I'm remembering now.
We did. No, we ran. Did we run it? Yes, we ran a test. We ran a site monitor on Mauna Loa. Mauna Loa Solar Observatory, solar? Atmospheric Observatory, anyway, is the source of the carbon dioxide measurement that is now used to demonstrate global warming. So at the end of the Second World War, they began testing atmospheric things, amongst which was CO2. And they're at 12,000 feet or so. You drive up there to the left, across the lava flow, right, which has now cooled, they plowed. But it's very, it's compacted lava, so it's fine. But right at the road edge, it's uncompacted. It's very sharp. You drive there, you'll tear your tires to pieces. So I took my machine up there. I hired those guys to run it for us for a couple, 3 weeks. And they were very gracious, good. But they said, we don't want you up here because all the traffic will screw up our atmospheric test. But we'll run your damn machine for you. So I installed it, and I came up the next day. I was staying at Hilo to train them, right? So I get up there, and there's this blinding snowfall. It was snowing to fairly well, even at 9,000 feet, well, 10,000 feet. So I start up this black cinder road, knowing if I get off into the black lava, I'll tear my tires off. I can't see beyond the hood of the car. I've got a rental car that you're not meant to take to the saddle road. So I was, but I made it. Then I trained them, and we came back. It's hard to train somebody how to use a solar telescope in the middle of a snowfall. But that's, that, yeah, we tried. We would have had to build a dam. I thought they were crazy. But in fact, you build a lava dam. You put a, so here's a telescope, and you put a big dam upstream of it, so when the thing erupts, the lava flows around. We would have been fine. But they didn't want us.
Yes, as I remember, it was both of those, the lava and...
and earthquakes. The disturbance.
Earthquake, yes.
I mean, they're bad on Mauna Kea, but they're worse on Mauna Loa.
Yeah. But let's get back to... The HVAC contract. Because my memory is that the decision was made by you and Hain on a trip to Haystack, and it was essentially to buy them off, to get their support for the funding.
Before?
I don't remember, Dave, whether
well,
before
you see,
or after.
Well, you see, I'm telling you, I had no management responsibility except in Tucson in the 1980s. I resigned 1 year into Mort, and we were still doing the 25-meter because I went with Mort, and we got slaughtered up at the NSF and lost the 25-meter.
We'll come back to the 25.
There was a movement at the time that the money would be better spent on VLBA, as I recall.
Let's come back to that. You may be right. You may not have been there, but Hain, certainly not.
Well,
Hain
would have been because he was a technical honcho for all that stuff. VLA, VLBA.
He was also the project manager.
It could have, but if it was, I was A, not, it was either before the VLBA per se when I was still in management, and it was a reconnaissance, but I can't believe we would let a contract. We had no money for it then. We may have let a design for VLBI. Could have done that.
No. It was...
Well, then I wasn't in management. Right. I may have been advising, but I was doing the millimeter array then. You have to look the dates up. I could be wrong, but...
Because I always felt we got sold out, or I got sold out.
Strange you should feel that way. Blood brother.
But you made some comment earlier about the nature of these contracts and the performance of Caltech and for the correlator and MIT Haystack for the record system.
Right.
Can you elaborate on that? Or?
Well, Caltech eventually, they couldn't keep up with the correlator, is my memory. And so eventually they had to reassign the contract to us, back to us, and we had to do the correlator. in the case of Haystack, they in fact delivered the recording units, but it was long and costly. And I think probably over budget and certainly over time. Because, well, they were in better shape than Caltech because they had a big research program partially sponsored by NASA. So they had good people with good money. But even so, it was technically very challenging. We were pushing the state of the... Yeah,
but they were more into the industrial mode than
yes.
Caltech was. Caltech was
yes.
couldn't get out of the research mode.
Right. So Caltech was almost doomed from the very signing of the contract. Whereas Haystack was just faced with a technical challenge that I would say, honestly, we probably all did not appreciate. So it's a bit unfair to blame them. And indeed, without Haystack, we would have not done very well.
Well, we would have built the record system based on the VHS tapes.
Yeah, but it would have been a different instrument. Those tapes didn't have the competence of the proposed Mark III.
Didn't have the...
Competence. Is my memory.
That was the other way around. They were very reliable.
Competence. The bandwidth speeds. That's my memory. But I would defer to you.
They didn't have the bandwidth that we ultimately did get from the Mark III. That's right.
No, the tapes were proven. Yeah, I agree. We'd use them.
Was it your impression? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is it your impression that we enter into both of those arrangements to get support, moral support, political support those institutions?
It is my impression that certainly in the case of Caltech we did, because we had as good correlator people as they did. It's a little less clear with Haystack because we didn't have the kind of confidence in that area that they did.
Well, we had proposed a different system based on the VHS recorders, and I forget who our engineer was at the time. They had designed the whole system, block design. It was Ben O'Rear.
Could have been. So. It's less clear in my mind, although if you tell me that we could have gone another way without Haystack and that we did Haystack to get their support, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know how we persuaded Iowa and Illinois to give up their VLB efforts. And once they closed their VLB station in Iowa, they stopped being VLB people, didn't they? Really painful.
After a few years of this, they were no longer interested. There's no fun in operating a 25-meter or 20-meter dish to record tapes and send the tapes off somewhere with no intellectual involvement. That's separate from the science that they were doing.
But well, they dropped out of the science too, didn't they?
That's because nobody appreciated that when they lost the contract to operate, they agreed they didn't want to operate.
Right.
It wasn't a good thing for students or anything.
Right.
They didn't want to operate these facilities.
Right.
But nobody, either at the institutions or us at NRAO, I think, appreciated when they lost the contract to operate the telescope, they lost their funding to do research. They were coupled, of course, because they didn't have... That's where they were getting their research money.
Right.
And then the NSF, because of the usual competition for grants...
They got killed.
Yeah, including Caltech.
Yep.
And your people like Reedhead went off to do...
background.
Cause of background stuff. And
yeah, so we...
That's what killed...
We basically almost lost a generation of VLB astronomers.
The users.
Yep.
By the time we built the VLBA, there weren't any American users left.
Yep.
Okay, let's finish up with the 25-meter.
Yeah.
You seem to think that somehow the VLBA, people advocating the VLBA undercut the 25-meter?
25-meter telescope was proposed at the height of the pressure on the 36-foot come 12-meter. In fact, I guess at the time it was proposed, it was a 36-foot. I think that 12-meter didn't come till maybe after the death of the 25-meter. Is that right? I think that's probably right. We could look those dates up. It'll be in Mark's book. But I believe at the time we were pushing a 25-meter, we had a 36-foot telescope. This is important not because of the size. 36 feet is equal to 12 meters, more or less. But the 36-foot surface was not capable of doing precision work at short millimeter wavelengths, whereas the 12-meter was better, plus a different dome, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But anyhow, I think we pushed 25 meters as the next logical step. And I note in passing that 30-meter in Europe has been quite successful. There were those that said the 25-meter wouldn't have any science to do. Those people, of course, in retrospect, were shown to be abysmally ignorant of the situation. So the 25-meter was blessed by the Decadal Review and became one of the approved programs of the NSF. However, it was blessed at the same time that those wretched Arabs locked up a bunch of our guys in Iran. And inflation went crazy, and the budget went crazy, and the president froze all new projects, including 25-meter. So the new president got those wretched Iranians to let our people go, and the oil started to flow like water, and the price of a barrel of gasoline dropped to reasonable numbers, and the NSF said, let's do a new survey. And the 25-meter was left out of that survey because it was an approved project. It was just not funded because of those wretched Arab people. However, in the course of deliberating this, the spending priorities came up, and our man in Arizona said to himself and the rest of the NSF committee at the time, this is Mr. Stripmatter I'm speaking about. Was it Stripmatter? I think it was. You know, this 25-meter, it's not as good expenditure of money, even though it's approved. Why don't we do this shiny new VLBA thing? That's new science.
Stripmatter?
Wasn't it Stripmatter? No, it wasn't. It was the...
McCrae.
No. Well, McCrae was certainly so, but there was the solar guy. That's the... And he came up to me afterwards.
After what?
After this meeting.
Which meeting?
This meeting at the NSF. I don't know when the date was.
That's,
it may be important to you, but
right.
At the moment, what's more important is me trying to get the name of this guy. Because he then ended up in Chicago. But he put his arm around my shoulder and said, Dave, I know you're disappointed, but you will look back at this later on and see that this is the committee made the right decision. I thought he was the chair, not McCrae, but McCrae was certainly there. Anyhow, whoever it was, this guy, instead, with his arm around my shoulder, it was pouring the salt into the wound. Anyhow, they felt that the time of the 25-meter passed. We had screwed around with the site for that thing. And... we ended up in Hawaii. There was a lot of people wanted to put it on Mount Lemmon, but we ended up pushing Hawaii. The same arguments: you go take the millimeter array to Chile. That wasn't good enough. It was going to be more expensive and native rights. Anyway, so it was formally turned down. Bill Howard was director of the NSF astronomy at the time, and Mort made a pitch, and Turner came up, made the science pitch. I was there. I was Morton's associate. I was making a pitch. But the committee said that 25 meters shouldn't be funded. And I'm not sure whether they said the VLB should be funded or not. But amongst the millimeter community, the VLB was considered to be the black hat in this whole episode. Fairly or unfairly, I state that as a fact, not an opinion. It may have been a fair assessment. It may have been a really unfair assessment. I don't take a position on that. I just state the fact that in the millimeter community, there were certain VLBA persons who were not at all welcome in their company. Fact. Then the millimeter community, basically said, you know, NRL doesn't know what they're doing. They screwed this up. They couldn't make a proper pitch for an approved telescope. We'll go off and do our own thing. So they got Bob
Wilson
to do good things, right? And there were some loud voices.
Al Barrett.
No, but there were some loud voices that thought NRL had let them down. And eventually, of course, everything was all lovey-dovey, and we got together and we made a millimeter array that got hijacked by RG. That's another story. But at the time, it was very painful in this. It wasn't a decadal review. It was an astronomy, an NSF astronomy panel.
Yes.
Oh, what's the name of the guy?
We have to find out.
Beckers, Jacques Beckers.
Oh, yes, right.
Jacques Beckers, yes. That was the guy.
Yep.
He ended up
yep.
with a... he ended up with a bimbo in Chicago.
I remember during the deliberations of
yes.
that committee.
Yes, were you there?
Yes. You don't remember that. But
well, the scars.
Yeah.
You know, big scabs.
I'll explain this offline later. But, my memory is that during the committee deliberations, open deliberations,
yes,
we were
yes,
all there.
Yes.
It was Dick McRae that who? First made the suggestion
right.
for the that time had passed for the millimeter ability to tell us.
That is my and we were surprised because McRae. I knew him very well through his stellar wind stuff, and the 25 meter was a perfect place to look for.
And part of the argument was you mentioned the 30 meter.
Yes.
That was part of the reason the time had passed. The 30 meter was already in operation.
Right.
And they would just do routine things or something.
Right. That's correct.
Okay. Anything else in your mind?
That's enough.